Training for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, what it may mean for life and death cases to come now that Governor Jeb Bush has allowed a vegetative woman to be fed again.
Also, for abortion cases to come, the impact of President Bush's plan to sign a bill banning so-called partial birth abortions.
Alleged sniper killer John Muhammad turns a Virginia courtroom on its head. He won't represent himself after all.
And if you're getting old, get it together.
The best planning is to have a durable power of attorney and a health care proxy whereby the parent names the child or whomever to be able to step in at no cost, no courts involved. It's an easy transition.
These stories and the most comforting comfort food coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The suspect in the D.C. area sniper shooting trial is no longer representing himself. John Muhammad spent the last 2 days defending himself, cross-examining experts and even one of his alleged victims. Now his attorneys, who have been on standby, have resumed their role. Muhammad is being tried on one murder out of the 10 slayings that occurred a year ago. This murder is of Dean Harold Myers. He was killed while filling up his car at a gas station in Northern Virginia. President Bush has begun a brief visit to Australia. He'll thank the Australian government for its military help in Iraq and its efforts in fighting terrorism. Kathy Harper reports from Melbourne.
President George Bush's Air Force One plane has been escorted into the Australian capital, Canberra, amid an unprecedented level of security in the city. Australian fighter jets will patrol the skies over the city for the duration of Mr. Bush's visit, and elite anti-terrorist troops will be ready on the ground if needed. During his brief 21-hour stay, the President is scheduled to meet with Australia's Prime Minister John Howard and address the Australian Parliament, which has been recalled specially for his visit. Before Mr. Bush's arrival, several thousand people who objected to the war on Iraq demonstrated in Australia's largest city, Sydney, and there were smaller protests in other cities. More demonstrations are planned. For NPR News, I'm Kathy Harper in Melbourne.
The captain involved in last week's New York fatal ferry crash is refusing to cooperate with the federal investigation. Federal officials have subpoenaed Captain Michael Ganzo because he canceled a scheduled interview with the National Transportation Safety Board. The assistant captain of the ferry, Richard Smith, remains in critical condition. He went home after the crash and tried to commit suicide. Wisconsin residents have recalled a longtime state senator from member station WUWM in Milwaukee. Marty Michelson reports.
Gary George held the inner-city Milwaukee Senate seat for nearly 23 years. Yesterday, he was swept out by a 2-to-1 margin. The recall effort began after George angered constituents when he sided with Republicans in voting for the state budget and against Democratic efforts to expand gambling in Wisconsin. Only 8% of the electorate turned out in what analysts said was a recall without a real hot-button issue. George was unseated by a longtime Democratic colleague, Representative Spencer Coggs, who served in the state assembly for more than 20 years. Coggs will go on to be the only candidate listed on next month's general election ballot. But he says he doesn't rule out a challenge from George in a write-in campaign. For NPR News, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
It's Game 4 of the World Series tonight in Miami. The New York Yankees lead the Florida Marlins 2-1. Roger Clemens will pitch for the Yanks. It could be one of his last official trips to the pitcher's mound. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 114 points at 96.32. The Nasdaq is down 32 points at 19.08. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, media corporation Time Warner is reporting a big jump in third-quarter earnings. The news comes less than a week after it officially dropped AOL from its name. Fred Mogul of member station WNYC reports from New York.
Net profits at the multimedia giant rose to $541 million, or 12 cents a share, up from $57 million, just 1 cent a share, this time last year. Much of the gain comes from restructuring and a $127 million pre-tax gain on investments, including sales of China.com shares. The company's AOL Internet unit continued to suffer, dropping hundreds of thousands of subscribers and watching advertising revenue plummet by a third. The publishing unit, which includes Time Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, and People, also lost money. The company says it expects to receive more than $1 billion by selling off its DVD and CD manufacturing business and its Atlanta-based NBA and NHL sports teams. For NPR News, I'm Fred Mogul in New York.
A federal judge is urging jurors to reach a verdict in a fraud trial against former Credit Suisse banker Frank Quattroni. He's accused of telling workers to destroy files on how his company allocated shares of technology stocks during the Internet boom. Jurors are on the fourth day of deliberation. They've indicated to the judge that they substantially disagree with each other. Telecommunications equipment maker Lucent has reported a profit for the third quarter of this year worth $99 million. It's the first time the company's reported a profit in more than 3 years. Lucent has worked to come back from an enormous slide. Its stock was once worth more than $90 a share. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In Florida, excruciating decisions on life and death and what to do when someone's in a gray zone hovering between life and death. Now that the Florida legislature's voted to allow Governor Jeb Bush to have a vegetative woman's feeding tube reinserted, Terry Schiavo's being hydrated, not fed yet so far, 13 years after the now 39-year-old woman suffered a catastrophic heart attack. Her parents are pleased about the legislature's action, but a lawyer for her husband said Schiavo was literally abducted from her deathbed. Governor Bush's decision overturned years of court rulings favoring the husband's position. He wanted her to be allowed to die. Joining us on the line now is Craig Walker from the Associated Press. He joins us from Tallahassee, Florida. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Right now, Terry Schiavo is being rehydrated, Craig. When is her feeding tube expected to be reinserted?
We actually don't have any word on that, and so far today we haven't received word on her exact condition. There are so many things up in the air about this right now, from her exact physical condition to exactly when any possible legal challenges might be filed. Mm-hmm. We just don't know a whole lot yet.
Do we know what the next legal avenue for opponents of what the governor and legislature did might be?
Well, there are a couple of ways. Her husband, Michael Schiavo, of course, can start at the very beginning and challenge this new law through the circuit court and go up the line. He could go to the state Supreme Court, but the state Supreme Court has already refused to get directly involved in this case.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually kind of surprised that so far, at least, there hasn't been anything filed.
Hmm. What's the sense in Florida, Craig, about how well-informed the legislature was when it made this decision? This is the sort of thing courts have pored over for years. Did the legislature pore over it, or did politics lurk behind this decision at all?
I don't know if it was necessarily politics, Bill, but of course, this is the type of issue where you have a tremendous amount of emotion on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
This law was jammed through in a big hurry without hearings. That is, of course, one of the things the critics are saying, that this is supposed to be a deliberative process, and there was virtually no deliberation. In the moves to alter or approve a new state budget each year, there's a 72-hour waiting period, and there was nothing like that here at all. The legislature met in special session to discuss some economic issues on Monday morning. The House had approved this by Monday night, and by last night it had been approved in the Senate, signed by the governor. Very quick process here.
Yeah. Craig, just briefly, what could the impact be on future cases? Do you have a sense of that down there, involving people in vegetative states where families are at odds about what to do about that, or even organ donation when families are at odds about what to do about that?
This is one of the biggest questions of all, Bill. The one thing that this case has done is spur a huge new interest in the websites that offer a living will. There are folks who may have considered this in the back of their mind, and now they're saying, I do not want to be in the position of any of the folks involved in this case. If it's their child involved, if it's a spouse involved, if it's themselves involved, the living will issue is huge. Beyond that, there are constitutional questions here, and it's one of those things that is really an open slate right now.
Really a tumultuous decision. Craig Walker from the Associated Press, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Craig Walker joined us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Both sides are squaring off in what's sure to be a continued abortion rights battle after the Senate voted yesterday to ban a procedure the ban's supporters call partial birth abortion, but which is medically known as intact dilation and extraction, or DNX. President Bush says he'll sign it. Abortion rights supporters say it's too broad and doesn't make exceptions for a woman's health. So they're promising to take the new law all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if need be, to the same justices who 3 years ago struck down a similar ban on partial birth abortions in Nebraska. Joining us on the line is the doctor who fought that Nebraska ban and plans to fight the new one, Dr. Leroy Carhart. And doctor, on what grounds are you challenging the proposed law?
We need to make it clear to the people that this is not a ban on late-term abortions. And we also need to make it clear that it's not a ban on one procedure. Why we will challenge it because this law would criminalize all of the safe medical methods available to terminate pregnancies as early as the 12th week.
Hmm. Well, and I'm going to go right to the language of the bill, because you're right. It doesn't mention late-term abortions or DNX or partial birth abortion. What it says is it prohibits a doctor from deliberately and intentionally vaginally delivering a living fetus until, in the case of a head-first presentation, the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother, or in the case of breech presentation, any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother for the purpose of performing an overt act that person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus. What bothers you about that language?
There's no way of knowing when I start a procedure what percentage of the fetus is going to be outside of the cervix or outside of the vagina or outside of the woman's body before fetal death occurs. There's no way to prove that, yet every abortion that I've done after the 14th week past conception, every abortion that I've started after that time, up until the time that I can induce fetal demise, would be covered by this ban. I would either have to accept unsafe methods or less safe methods to terminate the pregnancy, or I would have to not do an abortion at all. I should not be forced to practice medicine under the fear of prosecution under every safe procedure I do.
What other objections do you have to the law?
It elevates the fetus to a level far above the mother. I have to worry about what I do to the fetus and not what I do for the health of the mother. That's what I object about this bill. There's no time in my practice where I feel that I should subject a woman to unnecessary risks of life, of bleeding, of sterility or infection. There's no reason I should be forced to do that to adjust the way that a fetus dies.
Well, doctor, as you know, a majority of Americans do agree with Congress. They are against this procedure, especially when they think of a fetal skull outside, a living fetus with a skull outside of a woman's body. There are a lot of Americans who are against this. What would you want to say to them?
Women that I've had referred to me that I've treated have been HIV/AIDS patients in severe medical or dire medical circumstances that needed their pregnancy terminated as fast as possible, because when you're pregnant, your immune system is compromised and your body is unable to fight diseases that it may have fought well when you're not pregnant. I've had diabetic people that were very gravely ill that were pregnant and needed to have their pregnancy terminated. People that have severe liver disease, and a woman that just recently that was in total renal failure on dialysis. All of these patients, I need to worry what's the safest way and what I can do to terminate the pregnancy as safely and as quickly and as free of other complications as possible.
Dr. Leroy Carhart runs a clinic in Bellevue, Nebraska. He's planning to challenge the soon-to-be-signed ban on so-called partial birth abortions.
Now we turn to Douglas Johnson, the legislative director of the National Right to Life Movement, to discuss legal challenges to the partial birth abortion law. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Good to be with you.
Mr. Johnson, doesn't precedent concern you? The Supreme Court rejected a similar law in Nebraska 3 years ago, as I'm sure you know, saying its language was too broad and that it might wind up outlawing other types of abortion kind of in its wake if it was allowed. Doesn't that make you pessimistic?
Well, we've never predicted what the current Supreme Court would do with this bill, but it was a 5-4 decision 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, the five justices did take, in our view, a very extreme position. They said Roe versus Wade really protects the right of an abortionist to use the method that he wants, even in the late second trimester, even partial birth abortion, really any time that he sees fit. That was the doctrine of the five justices who were in the majority. But there were four who thought the Nebraska law was fine. And one of the problems that the majority had was the definition of partial birth abortion. As you note, Congress has since rewritten the definition in this bill, which is about to go to President Bush, to make it even more explicit and specific.
Yeah.
And we do not believe that the description, the definition, I should say, in this bill, which says explicitly it's only a partial birth abortion if the baby is delivered while still alive outside the body of the mother, past the navel, past the belly button, if feet first, or the entire head, if head first, how that can possibly be mistaken for any other abortion method. But I'm sure that there will be strained arguments presented to the judges in that respect.
But there will also be the argument that the bill doesn't make an exception for the health of the mother, and that's concerned the Supreme Court as well, right?
The five justices also had an objection on that, and that goes back to their very expansive definition of Roe versus Wade, under which really anything goes, even after viability, if a mother's emotional health is deemed to be affected. But in this case, two things. First of all, that was a 5-4 decision, and we could hope by the time this bill gets up to the Supreme Court that there would be a shift in just one vote away from that extreme position that could occur through a justice saying that this is a different law or saying I got it wrong the first time. Or, of course, there's always the possibility of a change in personnel. So with the five,
but what if that doesn't happen? What about this health exception problem?
Well, the Congress has addressed it by laying before the court in the bill here very extensive congressional findings. So in the Nebraska case 3 years ago, the court was basing it on the findings of one trial judge, one U.S. district judge. Now, on the basis of very extensive congressional hearings, both houses of Congress, by two-thirds votes, are declaring a different and we think more accurate set of facts. The Supreme Court has deferred to Congress's fact-finding abilities in the past in some other contexts. We can't predict how much deference any justice will give it in this case, but there's a lot of medical evidence being presented here in the text of the bill now by Congress that this is never medically necessary, and indeed that this abortion method poses unique risks to women even over and above other methods of abortion.
What happens to abortion rights, do you think, Mr. Johnson, if this law is upheld by the Supreme Court? Does it pave the road for further legal challenges to abortion rights down the years?
This bill does not challenge the core holdings, if you might say, of Roe versus Wade, which regrettably six justices currently support. But it certainly does take the mask off of Roe versus Wade as far as revealing what extreme effects it has had. We believe that legal protection should be restored to unborn children. We hope that ultimately Roe versus Wade is overturned, and that would, of course, have the effect of putting the matter back in the hands of the people we elect to draw the lines where they believe they should be drawn with respect to protection of unborn children.
Douglas Johnson, legislative director of the National Right to Life Movement. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
I'll fake it through the day with some help from Johnny Walker Red. Send the poison brain down the drain to put bad thoughts in my head.
And this note, Elliot Smith, the singer-songwriter whose dark, introspective songs graced the film Good Will Hunting, died today, apparently of suicide. Smith once said his favorite band was the Beatles, but he was most often compared to Nick Drake, who also took his life. Smith's best-known song, Miss Misery, was nominated for an Academy Award. Elliot Smith was 34.
Living in the park. Said, man, you mean you had
for both of us.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now.
To a place I've seen in a magazine.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, living trusts, living wills, life insurance. Living to a ripe old age can be complicated. Assisted living, or sell the house to the kids and live in it for the financial breaks. All of these issues are addressed in a book by attorney Steve Weissman. It's called A Guide to Elder Planning, Everything You Need to Know to Protect Yourself Legally and Financially. And Steve joins us in the studio. Welcome, Steve.
It's good to be with you.
You can also read this as Everything to Protect Your Parents Legally and Financially.
I'm an aging boomer, and we call it the sandwich generation because we're taking care of kids, we're taking care of parents. So it wasn't aimed just at seniors, but it was aimed at baby boomers and younger people who are dealing with aging parents.
And also trying to plan their own future. So tell
Very
us.
Very much so.
Yeah. What is the thing that gets people into the most trouble?
Not planning early enough. There's always something you can do. As a matter of fact, the original title I wanted for the book was Looking for Loopholes. And throughout the book, there are little loopholes for people.
Give an example.
For instance, one of the things is with an IRA. If you're going to leave an IRA to a spouse and then to children, you can do it in a fashion by setting up your beneficiary designation where you can continue the tax deferral, or with a Roth IRA, no tax at all, for multiple generations. And yet, if you don't make that beneficiary designation correct and done while you're alive, it goes into your estate, comes out of your estate, still to the same people, but it comes out over 5 years instead of, say, 60 years. So those are the kinds of things that try and get people to look at.
Well, and I was amazed at how many others there are. For instance, you write a great deal about how the elderly who might be having a second marriage should sign a prenup.
You know, prenups, it's not just for breakfast anymore. I mean, it isn't something just for younger people. And in fact, I think it's maybe more important when you have second marriages. And you often do have seniors marrying after years of perhaps divorce or being widowed. And you need to be able to plan for second families or plan for the first families. And then there's also, beyond just prenups, there are a lot of seniors who are living together, sometimes for tax reasons, sometimes for other reasons. And there again, a very specifically worded living together contract is it's a very, very important thing to do.
Because, I mean, it struck me it was so much more important even than it is for first time married, for second time married, because you have to decide, do you want to leave your things to your children? And if you don't sign that prenup, it might go to your second spouse, and that might not be what you wanted.
Exactly. There's also something called a Q-tip. Mm-hmm. It's a special form of trust where you can leave money for a surviving spouse, but this spouse may not be good at managing the money, and you want to make sure that it's there for that person, but also available to your children when he or she passes away. This is a trust that has very much in the way of tax advantages, and yet it'll pass to the kids after the surviving spouse's death.
Hmm. The Q-tip.
Yes.
Okay. What do you say to people who are advising their parents or elderly who are right now spending down their assets because they're afraid if they have any money to show, they're going to get hammered if they need Medicaid?
And that is perhaps the biggest issue that I'm facing with people. We have a government I'm trying to think of something that we can say on the air that I can get away with. I mean, it'll include all of George Carlin's words because they totally ignore the problem. A good example was in 96 when we had the Kennedy-Kassenbaum law, a cornerstone of what they thought Medicaid planning was, make granny go to jail or charge the lawyers with criminal offenses, the criminal offense, advising a client how they legally could get on Medicaid.
Because we should say that there are some people who could abuse Medicaid. They would shelter their money or their assets with family members to appear eligible for free Medicaid. But most of the elderly are poor, you know, and they have to spend their savings before they qualify. So what do you recommend for them to do that's legal?
Bottom line is right now you can, if you have a married couple, there are ways you can save every penny and make that person eligible for Medicaid. There are things such as annuities. They have to be special kinds of annuities that'll take assets that would be countable assets and turn them into non-countable assets. It's a complicated system, but one that is aimed at first and foremost, not just providing care for that person in the nursing home, but very often there may be a bordering on destitute community spouse, they call them. And that's the person that most elder lawyers really focus on. How can we protect that person as well as, the government's going to protect the taxpayer. We're looking to protect our clients. It can be done.
I'm hearing you say consult and find out. One last question. If you have an elderly parent who you feel is incapacitated and can't make the right decisions about their estate but is determined to do so, what can you do?
It's one of those things that, again, the earliest planning, the best planning, is to have a durable power of attorney and a health care proxy whereby the parent names the child or whomever to be able to step in easily, quickly, at no cost, no courts involved. It's an easy transition. But if it isn't done, in those instances, you have to go to court and get a guardianship appointed, a guardian or a conservator. A conservator if you're only managing money, a guardian if you're dealing with health care issues as well. It can take some time, it can be somewhat privacy invading, and it can be costly. But if it's all that you have left, that's what you got to do.
Healthcare proxy and power of attorney.
Yes.
Okay. Steve, there's much more in the book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Weissman's book is called A Guide to Elder Planning, Everything You Need to Know to Protect Yourself, Legally and Financially.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Bush administration has its hands out in Madrid Thursday, hoping for handouts from allies to pay for Iraq.
And musicians from Gunther Schuller to John Medeski on celebrating 100 years of making music in the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, alleged sniper John Muhammad agrees to let his lawyers defend him. After 2 days, it seems obvious he wasn't able to defend himself.
When he addressed a police officer, he says, "So you saw me coming out of the parking lot, but did you believe my story?" So in a way, he's putting himself at the scene.
And taking comfort in comfort food.
Scientists are actually telling us that in the face of chronic stress that's biologically driven, these comfort foods can calm the nerves.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. President Bush has arrived in Canberra, Australia, the last stop on a tour of Asia. Mark Smith reports that the president is shrugging off North Korea's reaction to his new offer to solve, to solve the nuclear standoff.
The North has been demanding a non-aggression pact as a condition of scrapping its nuclear efforts. Bush's counteroffer, non-treaty security assurances, countersigned by Pyongyang's neighbors. But the North Koreans have now rejected that idea as laughable. At a news conference in Indonesia, Bush said it's hard to tell if Kim Jong-il is serious.
We're willing to advance a multi-party security agreement, assuming that he is willing to abandon his nuclear weapons designs and programs.
Later, aboard Air Force One heading here, Bush told reporters dealing with the North Korean leader requires a degree of patience. Mark Smith with the president, Canberra, Australia.
The United Nations is accused of putting hundreds of its staff at risk in Iraq. An independent panel says the UN is responsible for major security failures that led to avoidable casualties in the August bombing of the UN headquarters in Baghdad. The report cites widespread violations of UN security procedures and a lax attitude by UN leaders. The August blast killed more than 20 people, including the top UN envoy in Iraq. The defense is moving forward in the trial of Washington, D.C. sniper suspect John Muhammad, who decided today that he would no longer represent himself. Muhammad's two attorneys took over in court today and launched a series of objections and won many of them. On the witness stand was a New Jersey man who claims to have sold a car to the defendant that was used in the sniper killings. A man who went over Niagara Falls with only his clothes as protection says he was driven by depression, not a desire to become a daredevil. 40-year-old Kirk Jones of Canton, Michigan, is charged with illegally performing a stunt. Jones is the first person known to have plunged over the falls without safety devices and lived.
I thought he was odd when I looked at him. I figured he was attempting suicide because nobody is going to go over the falls and survive, is what I'm thinking. My heart was racing, you know, afterwards when I heard he was okay. I almost wanted...
You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Accused sniper killer John Muhammad having earlier this week amazed a judge and his own lawyers when he decided to argue his own case has now again turned a Virginia Beach courtroom on its head. He's changed his mind, deciding he won't, after all, be his own lawyer. Joining us now is Marcia Slacom Green, who's covering the trial for The Washington Post. She joins us from the press room near the courthouse. Marcia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure.
Marcia, this morning, lawyers Jonathan Shapiro and Peter Greenspun again became John Muhammad's lawyers. What's going on here?
Well, after a bench conference, Allen Muhammad decided that it was no longer in his best interest for him to represent himself, so he's decided to go back to his counsel.
What do you think led him to that decision?
Well, there was some discussion yesterday. Prosecutors actually asked the judge to remove him from representing himself because they indicated it was clear that he didn't know the law well enough and that, in fact, he was having to consult with his attorneys, which he was not supposed to do as long as he was representing himself. In other words, they couldn't tell him when to object and things like that. And from where the prosecution stood and from where the rest of us were sitting, it seemed as if he may have been leaning a bit on his attorneys.
He's facing overwhelming evidence, isn't he? Why do you think he made the call in the first place to represent himself?
Well, that's not clear at all, but apparently from background, this is something that he had been asking his attorneys for some time, but they thought they had resolved the issue, and he had just said he wanted a chance to speak because he knew what had happened. Now, he's got very able attorneys. The defense attorneys are some of the best in the state of Virginia, but it seemed as if he wanted to be able to address the jury, and that's what he did in what was a very surreal opening statement, very confusing, very much off the point in that he didn't even indicate how he planned to defend himself.
An accused killer quoting scripture, among other things. Some found that a little hard to take.
Exactly. And some of the witnesses, the early witnesses, also found it difficult just having him question them.
Yeah, yeah. Marcia, can he change his mind again legally?
Well, that's a possibility, but I think having gone through this once, it would seem that the judge would be very reluctant to have them switch again. The judge didn't address that issue this morning, but at this stage of it, it seems as if Mr. Muhammad is content to leave this case in the hands of his lawyers now.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any way that you can tap into how this might affect the jury one way or another?
Well, not from where I sit. It's hard to really figure out what the jury is thinking. But when Muhammad was doing his cross-examinations, he continuously asked different witnesses, did you see me there? Was I there? Or when he addressed a police officer, he says, so you saw me coming out of the parking lot, but did you believe my story? So in a way, he's putting himself at the scene, which has got to be making an impression on the jury.
Is your sense that this man is crazy?
I certainly wouldn't want to say that. I mean, that's up to a medical doctor to figure that out. But yeah. I think what we've seen in terms of what he's done in court is a man who clearly likes to be in control. Having interviewed lots of people who've known him over the years, he's a guy that likes to be in control and has been very good over the years at manipulating people and situations. And I think you saw that in the first couple of days of this trial.
Marcia Slacom Green of The Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Marcia is covering the trial of John Muhammad in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Well, choosing to represent oneself in a death penalty trial is not all that common, but there are a few high-profile cases that come to mind in which the defendants decide to forego lawyers. There's Ted Bundy, the Florida serial killer who confessed to 28 murders and was put to death in 1989. There's the so-called Long Island Railway killer, Colin Ferguson, who was convicted of killing six people on a commuter train rampage and sentenced to life in prison. And currently, there's Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 9/11 20th hijacker. Well, joining us on the line is Edward Schwartz. He's visiting professor of law at Boston University. And Professor, Bundy and Ferguson were not successful. How successful are other self-defended defendants?
Generally not very successful. Mm-hmm. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a defendant who represented himself and fared better than he would have had he had a lawyer.
Why is it so—I mean, it would seem obvious that you don't have all the legal expertise behind you, but why else is it such a bad idea to represent yourself?
Well, in addition to the problems with navigating the maze of criminal procedure at the trial itself, there are issues of appeal that have to be thought of as the trial is going on, and lawyers are trained to think this way, to always think ahead. And one of the things that's important is that in order to preserve an issue for appeal, you have to make a timely motion or a timely objection during the trial. If you haven't objected at the right time during the trial, you're out of luck.
Maybe I've watched too much TV, but it seems as if those who defend themselves have some sort of appointed lawyers who are advising them.
That's correct. And in this case, we had two standby lawyers who were assigned to Mr. Muhammad's case. The problem is that the courts do not allow any form of sort of hybrid representation. As the trial itself is going on in the courtroom, either you're representing yourself or your lawyers are representing you. You can't have it both ways.
When else can a court step in? In other words, can a court overturn your right, your request to defend yourself?
Absolutely. Very few of the trial rights that we think of are absolute rights. And the right to proceed pro se, that is, represent yourself, is one of those rights that, in fact, is not an absolute one. If the judge determines that you're being disruptive to the courtroom, that you're not adequately following the rules of criminal procedure, or that you're simply incompetent to continue, then the judge can actually step in and insist that you use a lawyer.
Well, you know, that does bring up the point. Some people say, you know, it's insane to try to defend yourself. And in fact, some people say that Colin Ferguson, for instance, or Ted Bundy were insane. Why would somebody whose mental capacity is questioned be allowed to do that?
Well, there is a rule which says that your waiver of the right to a lawyer has to be a knowing and voluntary waiver, which means that the judge has to determine that you're competent to make that decision. And in Masui's case, the 20th hijacker case, the judge was very careful to insist on psychiatric evaluation in advance to make sure that he was competent to make that decision. Well, Muhammad here has refused all requests to have him take a psychiatric evaluation. So the judge really could rely on very little other than the way that he presented himself before the court.
Well, I'm sure that court watchers such as yourself knew that when he said in his opening remarks, how do they, the prosecutors, know what happened? They weren't there. I was. It was, seemed to be a tip-off that this wasn't going to go very well for him.
That's correct. Those are words that it's unlikely his lawyers would have used in their opening remarks.
Yeah. Well, Edward, thank you.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Edward Schwartz, visiting professor of law at Boston University.
Still to come, comfort food. It's a relief and the rage. Our resident chef tells why.
You're listening to Here and Now.
In these tough economic times, a lot of people struggling in the job market have to get awfully creative to make a living. Nancy Rika Schiff has made it her mission to search out creative professionals. In her book, Odd Jobs, she profiles such people as a musical score page-turner and a safecracker and an odor judge, a woman who tests the efficiency of deodorants on real live armpits. Well, joining us is photographer Nancy Rika Schiff, who's returned from shooting the sequel to Odd Jobs. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for coming. You know, there are so many weird jobs in your book, page after page. It seems almost amazing no one thought of doing such a book before. How'd you get the idea?
Well, I was out at the Hollywood racetrack in Los Angeles, and I saw a very strange-looking man. And he seemed to appear after every race, and I asked him what his job was, and his job was to time the races. Mm-hmm. It was a job that I had never heard of, and it got me thinking about all the other unusual jobs there might be out there.
Huh. We mentioned a couple of the odd jobs from the first volume. Give us a preview of some of the weird jobs in the volume to come.
Well, I did a horse chiropractor, and actually, I'm looking now. I know there are people out there that do acupuncture on animals as well.
Tell me, Nancy, people who do odd jobs, are they uniformly odd themselves?
No, not at all. In fact, a lot of these people never even thought of their jobs as being odd until I approached them, and they would say things to me like, well, it's funny because people laugh when I tell them what I do.
Uh-huh. Nancy, did most of these people fall into the job they did? I mean, these are not jobs that you set out for when you got your BA under your arm and enter the job market. you don't say, what I really want to be is an odor judge.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Actually, the odor judge fell into her job by being a subject that they tested on first.
She was just so inspired by the whole experience. She said she had to do this herself.
Yes. There are actually a couple of jobs in the book that deal with the olfactory sense.
Name a couple.
Well, I have the perfumer.
Mm-hmm.
And also the dog sniffer, which is an interesting job. It's a woman who works at Hill's Pet Nutrition. And once a week, they smell the dog's breath to test the dog food that they are making to make sure that it's fighting gingivitis and all the other things it's supposed to be doing.
You've probably been asked this before, but of all the odd jobs you've stumbled upon, what's the weirdest?
The knife thrower's assistant.
Yeah, tell us about her.
The idea to me of someone standing in front of someone throwing knives at them has to be the weirdest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And they made me do it, actually. When I went to photograph them, at the end of the photo shoot, the knife thrower said to me, well, let me see how much you trust me.
Oh, wow.
And I actually stood there holding a balloon in my hand, and I let him throw a hatchet at me.
Reporter involvement taken to an extreme. What did that feel like?
It was pretty scary. I only let him do one, and I got it over with, and I took a deep breath, and I went home and I developed the film.
Wow. Well, we look forward to Volume 2, Nancy Rika Schiff.
Thank you.
Nancy Rika Schiff is the author of Odd Jobs, Portraits of Unusual Occupations. For a gallery of some of her photos, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with a discussion of comfort food, one that's part sociology, part psychology, and part culinary. So we've moved into the kitchen to find a little bit of comfort with resident chef Kathy Gunst. Hello.
Hi, Robin.
And you have some interesting statistics about a surge in comfort foods.
It's pretty fascinating. If you Google comfort food on the computer, 178 books pop up. Mm-hmm. There are over 20 brand new titles devoted to nothing but comfort food. Entire volumes devoted to macaroni and cheese, pot pies, a whole book on mashed potatoes. The list goes on and on. A few years ago, we were looking for sophistication. The French cuisine was hot. Everybody wanted to learn about Pan-Asian. Everybody was looking for trend, trend, trend. Well, now it's as if the whole world is kind of slowed down and stopped, and we're just seeking the comfort of home cooking.
You know, I was going to make a joke, you know, a whole book on macaroni and cheese, debating whether to put the potato chips on top or not.
Velveeta or no Velveeta, right?
But you're serious.
I am completely serious. There's a brand new, extremely popular book called Mac and Cheese, devoted to nothing but that. The point of all this is that everybody's definition of comfort food is different. Mm-hmm. I mean, what it comforts you probably doesn't comfort me.
Well, a lot of people define comfort food by potato. I mean, it just, that says it for them. So let's start with the recipe you've brought in. We'll talk more about the trend as well.
I think the thing about potatoes is that they're a fairly neutral food. They're bland, and they are inherently comforting because they can be mashed. They can be baked. I mean, for some people, I've asked a lot of people, what's comfort food to you? A lot of people said baked potatoes. What I like to do is a bit more elaborate and a bit more caloric, I must admit, which is another key component to comfort food. It does not pay attention to calories. This is the time when you say, I need something now, and it's not going to be a stick of celery. Right. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I brought in a bunch of different potatoes, and I'm going to make something called potatoes gratin. Now, many people have had this in different ways because there's a million ways to cook. Hey, maybe I'll do a whole book on potatoes gratin. What you do is you peel and thinly slice potatoes, and you layer them in a broiler pan or a gratin dish, and then you add herbs, and I add thin slices of Parmesan cheese, some milk and cream, and you just bake it until it oozes. And one bite of that, and whatever is bothering you in the world seems to melt away.
See, even just hearing about that makes me feel better. By the way, gratin dish?
Gratin dish is an oval dish that's not too high up on the sides because you don't want it to steam. Sometimes you can use a broiler pan, or you could use a baking tray or a cookie sheet for this. You really can't go wrong. You just don't want anything with the sides too high, or the potatoes will steam instead of bake, and we want them to stay tender.
Now, by the way, we're going to have this recipe on our website for listeners, or you can always call our listener line and get it. But in the meantime, back to the trend, there's a scientific reason for why comfort food makes us feel better.
This is really fascinating. There was a piece in the New York Times that talked about comfort food and its relationship to stress. Apparently, there are two types of stress. And comfort food, whatever that is for you, it might be chocolate pudding, it may be ice cream, it may be potatoes au gratin. It probably will be at the end of today. But this comfort food can actually slow down your stress. Now, doctors and scientists are not saying that you should start eating these extremely rich foods constantly. But if you've had a chronic situation, you know, where something's happening over and over and over again, it's not a great idea to turn to ice cream every time. But if you've had something that's happened and you really seek comfort, scientists are actually telling us that in the face of chronic stress that's biologically driven, these comfort foods can calm the nerves.
In the short term,
exactly.
You do it long term and you
long
are...
Long term, you become obese, and then we get back to the whole issue is why is America so overweight?
You have another problem.
Yes, that's right. But we're talking about that quick fix, and most of us can distinguish between this was the worst day of my life versus every day seems to be terrible.
So so there's science behind this as well as just a feeling that you have that it makes you feel better.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to ask you, what is your comfort food, Robin?
No question. Well, mashed potatoes, first of all.
Mashed, yeah. And
then the macaroni and cheese, but it has to be, you know, with tuna in it, and it has to have tomato.
Tuna?
Yeah.
Tuna as in canned tuna?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Now, is this about a childhood
dish?
Yes. Yeah, see, now, this is what's so fascinating, is that for most people, it's not a rational choice. They don't say, oh, mashed potatoes, because that just sounds so good and comforting. It does hark back to something. My mother, every Halloween, made spaghetti and meatballs for us because she wanted our bellies to be filled before we ate the candy. And there's something for me so sentimental about that, that I could weep just thinking about it. And I do this for my children. Every Halloween, we have spaghetti and meatballs. And Halloween for them means that. And it is so comforting to them before they put on their costumes and go out and get candy to actually eat spaghetti and meatballs, because it's almost like taking a kiss with you.
Well, you've lined a greased gratin dish with the sliced potato. And have you set your oven?
My oven is at 350, and the key to this also is thinly sliced potatoes. And I'm going to strip some fresh rosemary and sprinkle that on top, maybe a little fresh thyme. If you don't like herbs, then that's not going to be comforting to you. You don't have to use them. But that's all it is a layering of potatoes and herbs, and then a tiny sprinkling of flour and a little bit of cheese, and you put another layer on, and that's all there is to it.
So the flour goes between the layers?
Yeah, what the flour does is once you pour the milk and the cream on top, it helps thicken the whole thing and holds it together into this creamy mass. And it's just wonderful. And this is my hunk of Parmesan cheese. And instead of cutting it with a knife, I'm going to use a wide peeler, and I'm just going to shave strips of cheese right on top of the potatoes. Cheese tends to figure largely in comfort food. Grilled cheese, mac and cheese, cheese platters, cheesecake. There's something about, I think, the meltability of cheese that causes many people to associate it with comfort.
Again, pick your stress.
Yeah.
We can't do this all the time.
We can't do this every day. So I've layered the dish with potatoes and a layer of cheese and herbs, tiny bit of flour, another layer on top of all those things. I'm just going to pour some milk on.
How much?
I'd say about half a cup or so. You don't want to flood it. And then a tiny bit of heavy cream. You don't even need to use heavy cream, but it does give the dish a wonderful, thicker consistency.
Just, oh, what the heck? You've got cheese in
there. Comfort me. Comfort me, cream. A little salt and pepper, and we're going to pop it in a 350-degree, maybe 400-degree oven, and let it cook slow for about an hour. Would you like to see the result?
Yes.
Would you? Are you ready for my version of comfort?
Yes.
Okay. I happen to have one done just for you. I mean, just the visual appeal. It's got that golden brown from the cheese and the cream is cooked. This is a gorgeous-looking dish, but I want you to taste it, too, because I think no matter what your day's been, it's about to get better.
It's delicious. Here's what we want to do. Remind you, first of all, that you can get this full recipe and a video of Kathy cooking potato gratin at our website, here-now.org. And you can always call the listener line, 617-358-0397. Leave your name and number. We'll call you back with the recipe if you don't have computer access. But we also want to hear from you. What's your favorite comfort food? And, you know, let's answer this argument for once and for all. Macaroni and cheese with sprinkled potato chips or without?
What's going to be fascinating is to let us know where you're from. I want to see the geographical links to the comfort food. New Yorkers love lox and bagels with cream cheese. Give that to someone from the Midwest, and they're like, ew! So let us know what your favorite comfort food, what is it that you turn to on those down days, and let us know where you're from.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thanks, Robin.
Here now is resident chef Kathy Gunst.
And I feel nice, that sugar is mine. I feel nice, that sugar is fine. So nice, so nice, I got you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts. Canned mushroom soup or cheddar cheese soup in your tuna casserole, for instance. And, of course, your views on the news. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please mail us. Your letters can be sent to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
I feel good. I knew that I would. So good. So good. But I got you. So good.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
The Bush administration is reaching out for billions of dollars for Iraq. Will cash-strapped allies step in?
And celebrating 100 years of making music in one of the country's premier concert halls.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.